Following is an unrehearsed interview with Mr. I.O. Chitwood by Debbie Wilson for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at the home of Mr. Chitwood in Corbin, Kentucky on July the 20th, 1978 at 3 o'clock p.m. The first thing I want to start with, Mr. Chitwood, is just some personal background. Now, what is your full name?
My full name is Ira O. Chitwood.
And where were you born?
I was born at Isham, Tennessee.
What year?
In 1896, on October the 4th.
Who were your parents?
My father was Andrew J. Chitwood, and my mother was Minnie Williams. Incidentally, my mother attended school in 1892 at the Williamsburg Institute.
Which is here in Whitley County.
In Whitley County.
Okay, where were you educated?
I went to the high school at Harriman, Tennessee, and then I took a business course and started working for the Jellico Grocery Company.
Now, did you always work for the grocery company?
That's right.
Is that Jellico or Jellico?
It's Jellico, okay. J-E-L-L-I-C-O.
Now,
I worked for them 59 years before I retired.
What was your job with the company?
Well, I started in the office, and then when I went to Jellico, I was foreman of the shipping room. And at 20 years of age, I was manager of a branch at Manchester, Kentucky. And then I served as auditor in 20 and 21 at going to their different branches. And then I came to Corbin in 1921 as the branch manager. And then I worked as branch manager here until 1949 and was transferred back to Jellico as controller for the company. Incidentally, we operate branches in Kentucky and Tennessee, and at one time I had a branch in Florida. That made it convenient for off-season visiting.
Good excuse to go to Florida, huh? Mm-hmm. Well, now, who is your wife?
My wife was Helen Singleton, and she was from Maryville, Tennessee.
Do you have any children?
One daughter, Jane. And she married Hugh Evans of Corbin.
She's still here in Corbin?
No, they're in Washington, D.C. She's just retired from a position as business manager for the American Forestry Association, the national organization there.
Well, the first thing I want to discuss with you is just the earliest history that you know about Whitley County. I understand that your family was some of the earliest settlers into the county.
Yes, our family came in to what was then Indian Territory, and which later became Pulaski County. And then part of it became Whitley County, and part of it became Anderson County, Tennessee, then became Campbell County, Tennessee, and is now Scott County, Tennessee. And that's the political changes for the Chitwood settlement, which has been at the same place all the time.
But it's just changed states and counties.
They came there in 1795, and my third great grandfather's name was James Chitwood. He was a revolutionary soldier. And was born in Virginia. The Chitwood family came from England in 1695, or that Matthias Chitwood did, who was the head of our family. And in 1711, he married Mary Key, who was a relative of Sir Francis Scott Key, who wrote the National Anthem. Matthias received some land grants in Goochland County, Virginia, which is now Powhatan County, and his sons Richard and James went to North Carolina in the early 70s, 17 and 70, and settled in Rutherford County. James, on account of Tory activities, went to South Carolina to volunteer in the American Revolution. And later drew a pension for his service.
Did you
He left North Carolina in 1795 and settled in what was then Indian Territory in Kentucky, and which later became part of Pulaski County. And incidentally, he was a justice of peace in Pulaski County in 1813. And he resigned in 1821, and on May the 28th, on account of his reduced memory and the great distance of travel. In other words, he'd get halfway back home and think of something that he'd failed to do while he'd gone to court. It's a common affliction with busy people, you might think. And he had to ride horseback to get to court. There was no railroad in this country. This settlement carried the name of Chitwood for over 75 years. It is now has a post office address of Winfield, Tennessee. But as I said, at that time it was in Kentucky. And while he was a magistrate there, he was selected on a commission by Whitley County to help select the location of the courthouse, which and this commission did select where the town of Williamsburg is now. It's quite a little story attached to the selection of the courthouse. The commission was used to select it on account of so they would not be prejudiced to any of the gentlemen justices, as they were called, who wanted in their section of the county. And so James Chitwood and some other commissioners were selected who were not interested in where the courthouse would be, except just that it might better serve the public.
Well, how did they select the name of Williamsburg for the town?
It was named after Colonel William Whitley, who was a prominent Indian fighter and one of the early settlers of Kentucky. And William Whitley built the first brick house in Kentucky near Stanford, Crab Works. I've been to the house.
Now, who did they name the county afterwards?
The same man. Yeah. They didn't name the county. See, they petitioned that the governor in the legislature, when they created the county, they selected the name for the county. But then this special commission only selected the location of the courthouse and the name for the county seat.
Now, when was the county established?
It was established in 1818.
Well, now, I want to back up just a little bit. You mentioned the Indian Territory. Now, did your family or any of the other pioneer families that you know of, did you ever hear any stories about massacres or anything in this area?
No, not. I think our family got along rather peacefully with the Indians. The fact is, there was no Indian villages as such in this territory. It was more of a hunting ground for them. And some of my mother's folks, I've heard her tell, heard them tell of, and they pointed out the path near their home that they saw two Indians coming down, and they were dressed up with their war paint and fog. And they didn't realize that they were coming up on a house or a settlement, and that their grandfather took his rifle, and of course that was one of these cap and ball rifles that you have to load each time, and waited till one got behind the other and took aim and shot them both with one bullet. So that was the end of that raid. Speaking of using the, I asked some of the old timers, I said, well, why did they settle in this country anyway? He said, well, it was just full of game. And said, most of these fellows were hunters and like that. And they could clear the ground off and grow most anything they wanted to. I've heard my father tell about shooting 11 squirrels out of one mulberry tree with a single shot cap and ball rifle that he had to load after each shot. But it didn't make much noise, and so he'd shoot one and then load up again and then step behind the tree and shoot another one. And of course, those fellows were good marksmen. They didn't waste any powder.
Yeah. While we're still on pioneers, do you have any idea of what possessions they brought with them when they come into this new territory?
Well, they brought their horses and some cattle, and the women, of course, had brought clothes, bed clothing, and so on. And then my third great grandfather was a blacksmith, and of course he had his blacksmith tool. When he deeded on Christmas just before he died, the place to his youngest son, and then the day after Christmas, he put an MB to his deed and said, and my blacksmith tools. That was an important profession in those days. Make plows, wagons, do a little of everything with it. They had to use iron.
Well, what about pioneer customs? Do you know anything about their early customs, such as barn raisings or anything like this?
Well, not particularly. They all believed in their maker and established churches. And there was usually a mountain preacher in each bunch. I had one uncle who was a mountain preacher. He was the brother of my grandmother. His name was Jesse Lee. He was very famous in this part of the country, and they called him Fighting Chess, because he'd start to hold a meeting one time, and they, you know, these young roughnecks would try to run the preacher out. And so they told him about it, and he says, well, I can take care of that. So at the first meeting, he took off his coat and laid it on a chair and stepped up to the pulpit and said, now before we start the meeting, there's a little matter that I want to take care of. And it says it's been rumored that some of these boys intend to run me out of here. And it says if they'll make themselves known, and we'll step behind the church, and I'll take them on one at a time and see if any of them's man enough to run me out. So he had no takers. He went on with his meeting.
One way to handle it. Now, what did these early people do for entertainment? Do you have any idea?
Oh, they got together. They carried their musical instruments with them. And they liked to sing. And of course, they had some forms of dancing. Most of it was just good get-together of friends and relatives and talking about the different things. And then, of course, boys and girls don't have to do much talking. They can tell by the look in their eyes, you know, that they are having a good time just being with each other.
Well, what about moonshining? Now, was that something the earliest pioneers did?
No, there was no moonshining at all. It was legal to make liquor. You didn't have none of it was licensed by the government. My grandfather had a little still, and he made whiskey for his family use, and they used it in making their medicines and or maybe some social drinking. And they would keep their little still house locked up. They'd make whiskey once or twice a year, and if some neighbor would run out, they would let him have a gallon of corn or a gallon of rye. Yeah, but the price on the corn was 40 cents a gallon, and the price on the rye whiskey was 50 cents a gallon, and they consider that was a fair price for a bushel of corn or a bushel of rye, which it did take to make a gallon of whiskey. And so all the big families made their own. And it was legal. And the old man kept it under control.
Well, what about funerals? Do you know what the funeral customs were?
They had funerals, and they were all great believers. And so they, of course, there was nothing fancy about it. They made their own coffin and fixed them out of good material, lined them, and they would mark the graves. And later on, as soon as stones could be cut, well, they would put markers up. I found a marker in one cemetery of Pleasant Chitwood, and he was born in 1775 in North Carolina, and he died at the Chitwood settlement in 1853. And He had a marker that was cut out of a sandstone with his name. One was his wife, Sarah. And that's in a right, well-kept cemetery now. It looks real nice.
What about medical practices, old-time remedies?
Well, of course, the women were the ones really who looked after the health of the family. And it's amazing how well-versed they were on the preparation of food, keeping it from spoiling. And you never heard of food poisoning in those days. They didn't take any chances on it. They'd throw it out and cook some fresh. had been handed down from one generation to another about how to take care of food and how to take care of the sick people. They were experts with what they had to do with.
But just how did they preserve their food?
Well, it is mostly by pickling and drying. You see, canning in itself, and it didn't start until in the late 1800s. When Pasteur invented pasteurization, you see. But they could dry beans and apples and even meats were cured with salt and dried. And then they pickled things like corn, made the kraut, and they put their things like potatoes that keep them in a big hole in the ground. And then, of course, they pickle fresh corn in brine, same as they would cucumber. And, of course, they didn't have the variety that we have now.
Well, how did these people make a living?
They were farmers mostly in this area. And of course some made their living by, well, we'll take a kind of a roving type fellow who didn't like to farm or stay at home while he'd haul. Take his wagon, go after a load of salt. At maybe 50 or 75 miles away or to a, after the railroads started coming in, they would have to haul probably 50 miles, but they'd get just essentials. And a guy liked to do that. Why, he'd keep a team on the road, and he'd charge them, and they'd pay him probably in food or a small amount of money for it. And they didn't have much money. When it come time to pay taxes, they might sell off a calf or two, and that'd be all the money they'd need that year. It was a self-contained enterprise. My grandmother did the weaving for a family of 13. And I was talking to one of my cousins that had been up to visit her, and she said, grandmother took the oil lamp out to the little loom house and was working on some things. And she says, grandmother says, aren't you pretty tired after doing all this work today? Oh, she says, I don't get tired when I'm doing things that I want to do for my family. And you know, women are like that. They get to thinking about something and they don't mind working till midnight.
We'll move on up in time a little bit. What about the War of 1812? Did that have any particular effect here in Whitley County? That would have been before the county was actually formed.
No, not particularly.
And now, what about around the Civil War era?
Well, the Civil War, our family, and I've worked on our genealogy quite a bit. The area where I was brought up in was on the federal side. And I know of one man, his name was John H. Chitwood, and he and his three oldest sons all joined the, Tennessee had seceded, so they joined the federal army at Camp Dick Robinson. They were captured at Rogersville, Tennessee, by the Confederates. They spent the rest of their time in prison, Confederate prisons, and all of them perished there. John H. himself died at the notorious Andersonville prison in Georgia. Now then, when you got down to Georgia and Alabama and Virginia, the Chitwoods all fought on the southern side. And I have I got a list of all the veterans of the Revolutionary and the War of 1812, the Indian Wars, the Civil War. And there's around 50 Chitwoods that fought on the southern side, and 50 Chitwoods who fought on the northern side. And of course, you know, they conscripted them, or drafted them, as we say today, and they move around sometimes to keep them being drafted. And I found one fellow who had served on the Confederate side, and they paroled him, and after he was captured, and then he went to Arkansas and joined the Union side up there, and he drew a pension from the federal side. He served on both sides. But that happened in more instances than you would think about. Of course, when you were in, if you lived in Virginia, you were on the South. There was no question about that. And Scott County, Tennessee, had a unique position. When Tennessee seceded from the Union, Scott County seceded from the state of Tennessee and joined the, wouldn't support the secession. They took a fellow by the name of Campbell County Reed, was the clerk, and he took the books home with him, and there is no county records in the courthouse for the, unless they have been brought in, for the period during the Civil War. And they erected a bicentennial marker to the independent county of Scott. That was in 1976.
Pardon me, I'm going to turn the tape over. Side two of an interview with Mr. I.O. Chitwood. Now, Mr. Chitwood, before I turn the tape over, you were speaking about the Civil War. Was there any actual Civil War battles here in Whitley County?
I don't know about Whitley County. There was some action through here. And there was a Camp Wildcat up the other side of London. And fact is, one of the Chitwoods died there. That was a federal camp. And it was listed as measles. But they told me over Camp Nelson, it was actually smallpox that got into the camp. And I think they lost about 160 soldiers there. And then, of course, there was a battle in Camp Wildcat, short battle there. And they, of course, I think there's some records of different experiences people had with the soldiers when they'd be coming through. But as far as just a regular battleground, I don't know of any of that.
Well, what about the blacks in Whitley County during the Civil War? Did you ever hear anything about their situation?
Well, I'm not familiar with the immediate area around Williamsburg. There was a few blacks in the part of the county where I was living. But they all left when the Civil War was over. And there's no blacks over there now. Very much like it is here in Corbin. No blacks here.
There are no blacks in Corbin?
Might be two or three families.
So is that about all there are in the whole county then?
Oh no, there's a lot of them in Williamsburg and down that way.
Oh, well, now, what about the customs of the period during the Civil War? Did you ever hear any stories about this from your grandparents?
The what?
Customs during the Civil War, such as we talked about pioneer customs, but customs of the Civil War era.
Nothing that would be peculiar except just the regular farmers and mountain people, the regular customs that they had of the way they lived and the crops they grew and the things they did were all just normal living.
But what consisted of normal living at this time? Had it not changed from pioneer days, or just what was normal?
Well, we probably have more food and packages. Your basic foods haven't changed too much. The meat that we would eat, the vegetables that we would eat, the bread that we would make and eat, and then even making of soap. We made homemade soap. But you know, some people still do that as a hobby. And that live in cities and nice apartments, they take one of those soap recipes, make up their grease and perfume it, and make kind of a hobby of it. It's the same way with, now my grandfather didn't drink coffee. And of course, this section was never great tea drinkers, although personally I'm very fond of tea. But the early settlers, they drank milk mostly, and you know, even some religious organizations now have pledges from their members that they won't use either coffee or tea. And it may not hurt you, and it may do you some good. I always feel better in the morning after I've had a cup of coffee.
Picks you up, huh?
Yeah.
Well, what about, you mentioned religious organizations now. Had religion changed by the Civil War?
No, I don't think that changed any of there was one group of Baptists that was a little different over there. And most of the churches, those early churches, belonged to the United Baptist Association. I believe their headquarters is in Chicago. And of course, most of the Baptist churches now belong to the Southern Baptist Convention. And but this United Baptist was very active, more churches that than anything else, and there's several churches still belong to that association.
Well, what about forms of entertainment?
Entertainment. See, I worked in Oneida myself when there was not a picture show. Well, going to church, I know we didn't have a pastor over there, and we boys make up money to buy the oil for the lamp and the coal for the stove, and a little to buy the Sunday school leaflets. And he'd give us a place to go and a place to see the girls. I know the whole budget probably wasn't $5 a week. And that same church now is probably, I'd say $120,000 a year. That church is on the same location where we boys made up the money to buy the oil.
Well, now, what about education, like in the days of your, say, grandfather, father?
Well, they had good common school. My father wrote a beautiful hand. He write much better hand than I did. Script, he just like a copybook, shaded with the pen. And then they kept pretty good records of their business transactions. They probably did a better job of keeping records than we do. They put down the dates and births of their families, usually in a Bible, and then they'd make a will. A lot of people don't go to trouble to make a will anymore, but even if they just wanted to divide up a feather bed and the different things they had, well, they put it down and had somebody put it in writing. That was a good English cuss. Of course, sometimes they'd say to my daughter, Dicey, $5 and no more. In other words, probably didn't like who Dicey had married or something.
That was it.
Well, one interesting thing was Matthias, in his will, he mentioned that that his son Richard was to be the administrator. That's the one I'm descended from. And that he was to take care of his mother, his wife Mary, in the plantation. And if that didn't prove satisfactory, then he should provide a separate cottage. In other words, sometimes, a mother-in-law might not get along too well with the rest of the family, and it would be better to have her in a separate cottage. So, see, that happened then, and probably will, as long as we still have marriages and families.
Well, what about changes in transportation from, say, pioneer days to the Civil War days? How had roads improved?
Well, the roads improved, kind of like we do now. We get interested in road and go out and work on it and get one built. I served on this famous Cumberland Falls Road Committee, trying to get a road from Corbin out to Cumberland Falls. And in looking over the old records, when Anderson County was first formed in Tennessee, his Chitwood was right on the border. And he goes down to the first court meeting and asks him to to view out a road to his settlement, Chitwood settlement. And they appointed a road committee, and they reported back at the next meeting of the court, approved the road, and it was built from, that was Clinton, Tennessee. It was Burrville, Tennessee at that time. It was later changed to Clinton. And that was in 1802. And so I would say that that was the first road that went from there into the Chitwood settlement. Another interesting feature of that was that in 1806, the Postal Department advertised for a post route to be from Knoxville to Burrville, which is now Clinton, to Walnut Cove, that's C-O-V-E, to Chitwood. Incidentally, Chitwood was the only name of a settlement that was mentioned by a family name. And then to Wayne, which is now Monticello, to Pulaski Courthouse. And the route was to go every 2 weeks. And that's service hadn't improved too much since then.
When did the railroad come through?
The railroad down here?
Here in Whitley County.
I don't know the exact date, but it was around 1800.
It was that early in here?
Yeah. The railroad came, Corbin became a town pretty soon after the railroad extended their line on down here. You see, at the end of the Civil War, there was no railroad down here. Fact is, this Camp Wildcat, the cemetery that they had there, I read the government reports on it, and it was a nice kept cemetery, but it was too far from the railroad. That was 40 miles. The railroad just came to Crab Orchard at that time. So then that's one thing that a good program that the government did after the Civil War. They would go around to all of these places where soldiers had fallen by the road, be buried in a little local cemetery, in a person's garden lot, or a little camp cemetery. And these graves at Camp Nelson Wildcat were moved to Camp Nelson, a federal cemetery. And then any person that wanted their relative or loved one brought back home, they would take them to the local cemetery. So the Andrew Chitwood, who died at Camp Wildcat up here, he's buried in what was Chitwood, Tennessee at that time. And it was Chitwood, Kentucky first, and then became Chitwood, Tennessee. And it was he's buried in the little local cemetery there with a government mark. That was one of the programs. And it gave the soldiers something to do after the war.
Well, now you've mentioned Corbin and it being established about the time with the railroad. But then Williamsburg was later than that. Now, so Corbin is actually an older city than Williamsburg?
Oh, no. Corbin is a new town. I can find the dates for it, but it's about in 1884 or something like that. And I knew the fellow that selected the name for Corbin. His name was James Eaton.
Oh, I must have misunderstood something earlier. Now, I thought you said the railroad came around 1800 and Corbin was established about the same time. And then Williamsburg.
Yeah, to here. No, Williamsburg was established long before the railroads came.
Well, now.
18 and 18.
Okay, I've got that. But the railroad came in 1800 or 1880?
1880, a long time.
Oh, okay, 1880. All right, I misunderstood.
See, there wasn't any railroad down here during the Civil War at all.
All right, that's what I thought. Okay, I misunderstood it. All right.
All the settlements were built up along the waterways. And you can go around up and down these rivers now and find old apple trees that were planted by the early settlers. And then those areas after the railroads came through, they have grown up and become wilderness again.
Well, you said you knew the man that Corbin, that picked the name of Corbin. For whom was Corbin named?
He was named after a preacher that was named Corbin. I've forgotten his first name. However, there's a record of it. I mean, as far as it's not law.
Was he a popular man in the county, or?
He probably was. He was a well-known man.
Now, which is the larger city now, Corbin or Williamsburg?
Well, Corbin has the largest census, and then I think the business census that they take every 5 years, in addition to the other. The last one I knew showed Corbin as having a trading area of about 16,000, but I think it's more than that now.
Well, now we'll go back to the railroad. Just what was the impact of the railroad on this area?
Well, that was probably the most important thing that happened. And then, of course, the highways came on later, which helped develop the sections too. Actually, good roads, or roads even, just any kind of road is important to any place. You've got to get in and out. Even in Virginia in the early settlements, they had well-traveled roads. They had no highways and marked as such, but it's remarkable how people would travel from one place to another.
Well, now, we'll move on, and just while we're speaking of roads, what were the road conditions in Whitley County in your boyhood days?
Well, when I came to Corbin, there was not a highway leading into it. There was only dirt roads. There was probably 3-4 miles of an old railroad bed between here and London that was being used from the road from here to London. And you couldn't drive a car in the wintertime any place to speak of. A lot of people would just put their cars on blocks in the garage to keep them, to protect the tar. And the rubber wouldn't be any good for next year anyway because they didn't know how to cure rubber. Been a big advancement in. And you know how many miles you'd get out of a tar in those days? About 3,000. And they had a car down here that gave you a lead puncture proof tar they had in the window, and it had little metal scales in it. The reason where it got the name puncture proof. And is one that Dr. Sauer had driven, and it had about 5,000 miles on it, and that was considered very remarkable. I had a Model T myself, and so on Sunday afternoons, you could probably drive out 4 or 5 miles where the roads were smooth. And then you could, we had Main Street and Depot Street and 4th and 5th Streets, and East Main were the only paved streets in town. And so you just make that circle maybe 10 or 15 times each Sunday afternoon with your girlfriend and wave at everybody. And that was good, very good sport. Very productive. I did my courting in a Model T.
What year did you come to Corbin?
1921.
Well, now, when was this first pavement? Was it here when you got here?
Those streets were paved when I got here.
Well, what about the first street lights? Were they already up then?
Oh, yes, they had some street lights then. No stop signs, no stop lights or anything. They did have some, in order to control traffic, sometimes they'd make a one-way street and put a big marker in the middle of it and just say one way on it. Wasn't any stop signs.
Did Corbin have boardwalks or paved sidewalks by the time you got here?
Both. And in reading some of the old minutes, the specifications would call either for 4 inches of cut stone or concrete. And there was no difference in the desirability of either one. A lot of that cut stone was shipped in here from flat cars, from Mount Vernon, and I think some of it was acquired down near Williamsburg.
Well, now, did Corbin still have the saloons when you were first?
No,
came?
There was no saloons here then. The saloons went out when Prohibition. And however, in the early days, there was a saloon row here.
Was there a problem with violence here?
Well, just about like most frontier towns, there was always some boys that was out looking for trouble, and they'd find somebody that would just take them on. And they sometimes would get kind of rough.
Did you ever have any hangings or anything in Corbin?
Not while I've been here.
And none that you ever heard of, maybe from?
No, I didn't hear of any.
Well, now, while we're talking, or we've just been talking about roads, I understand, and you just mentioned it, about this committee that you were on to open up the road to Cumberland Falls. Now, when did you start trying to open up the falls?
Well, that was in 1927. We had run an ad in the all the towns in the Cumberland Valley here had gotten out of four. And we put $250 into it, and they asked us what we wanted to advertise. Well, we put a picture of our golf course, which was, we was just building, and somebody suggested we put a picture of Cumberland Hole in it, which we did.
Now, this is the town of Corbin?
This is Corbin. And so, pretty soon we got to getting letters how to get out there. Well, there wasn't any road from here to Corbin. So the Corbin Kiwanis Club appointed a committee to see if there's any way to get a road to the falls. And that committee was Wade Candler, he was the chairman, Tom Gallagher, and Robert A. Blair, and myself.
And I just tell me what you all did in trying to get this road established.
Well, they just as soon as we could, Wade picked up a car to make the trip. He got a Model T with high wheels on it, and puncture-proof tires, and then he had a, what they call a Morris transmission in it to climb steep places. And then Bob and I went over to the garage the night before we started out, and Bob was pretty good on painting letters, and so we put some signs on that. We want a good road to come and pull, Corbin Kiwanis Club. Had it on the sides and the back. And so we left about 5 o'clock one Sunday morning to find our way out. And it was all dirt road. And I'd inquired how to get there from, I had some customers, I've been in the wholesale business, and had some customers from down in there. And of course they told me how to get to their places, and then it was about 7 miles on further, just through the woods and over log trails and one thing and another. And so there was no bridges, and we'd go through the creeks to Ford. And when we got to the last little valley there, it took us over an hour to get up this old log road over the stepping stones and so on. We had to push and build up under the wheels. So we got there about 10:30. And it was a beautiful day in the summertime, and there was no mud, the road was dry anyway. And so we drove into the old Brunson Inn, went down there, and somebody said, well, it'll take more than those signs on that to get you back up the hill. But we had a nice day, and when we got back, we started working on the idea of building a trail out there ourselves. We called borrowed a grader from the State Highway Department. We had to furnish the gasoline and pay the men. They loaned us the machine.
Now, is this way you speak of, is that the club or the city of Corbin?
That's the club.
The actual club.
Corbin Club.
Well, pardon me, I'm going to get another take.